This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz has written a new novel in verse called The Wherewithal. It's set in San Francisco in 1968, and it's about a young man working in a series of menial jobs and trying to dodge the draft. He's also translating diaries his mother kept about a massacre of Jews at Jedwabne in German-occupied Poland in the early days of World War II. This was a real event that later shocked that nation and raised troubling questions about complicity and denial and the capacity for violence. Philip Schultz was a guest on Radio Times for his previous book, My Dyslexia. It was about being in the so-called dummy class in school and how his learning disability helped him to become a poet. He's the founder and director of the Writer's Studio. And Philip Schultz, a great pleasure to meet you and to have you here on Radio Times.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Your book is dedicated to a woman named Drinka Willen. I looked her up, but I'm curious about why you wanted to dedicate this book to her, who she is and why.
Well, she was my editor at my previous publisher for several books for the past 12 years, a great editor that I'm very lucky to know, and she's been involved with this book since it was an idea back in 2002 when I read Neighbors by Jan Gross. It's a history of Jedwabne, and I first told her about it, and she thought it was a good idea. And I had actually been working on the welfare material since I was 25.
And that's in the book as well.
That's in I always recognize that this inactive files, this basement of a welfare building in the middle of downtown San Francisco in the 60s when there was a carnival going on upstairs in the streets, and down there was all this dismay and this history of all the lower classes and the disenfranchised. So when I read Neighbors in 2002 and told her about it, it was the missing piece of the puzzle for me, because I knew I had a character and I knew I had a wonderful setting, but I didn't know what he was doing down there. And over the years, I attempted novels, several of them, and plays and poems, and I could never make it work. I failed, you know.
Well, let me pick up on the real story of what happened in Poland, because it's so much of your book in verse, your novel in verse, involves what happened. And this was a small town. It was 1941, so it was early on in World War II. And something like 400 Jews, maybe more, were massacred in this town.
There were around 3,200 people, and half were 1,600 were non-Jews, Catholic mostly, and the others were Jewish. And they had been neighbors for five centuries, and they did business together, and they worked for one another, and they went to they got along. They were neighbors, and when the Germans came in 1941, there was all the buried and hidden, although it wasn't completely hidden, anti-Semitism came out. And there are many explanations, but certainly a very basic one was it was an opportunity for the non-Jewish people to take the property of the Jews and get rid of them. And the Germans didn't ask them to. They obviously weren't going to scoff at the idea, and they were going to approve of the idea. But if anything, they liked the idea of some Jewish craftsmen were necessary for their war effort. So they, if anything, tried to restrain some of the Polish people. And the Poles ended up, there were so many Jews, 1,600, that the ones they couldn't pitchfork and club to death, they stuck in a barn and burned them alive, men, women, and children.
It's horrifying. I've read some of the descriptions of the Jews being herded into the middle of town, beaten, killed there. And then those that fled, they fled to a barn, and the barn was set on fire.
Well, no. I mean, they realized that they couldn't, there were too many to kill, and they actually rounded them up and ushered them through town, and they were like they were running the gauntlet. They were trying to kill as many as they could along the way, but the majority of them, the 1,600 people, is a lot of people to kill.
Yes.
They knew where they were headed. This Zelensky offered his barn, and he was going to be paid. The mayor was—this was organized, and they brought Jews from the farms in the outlying area, saying that they gathered in town for a meeting. And they pushed them all the way to this barn and nailed it shut and burned them alive, the vast majority of them, and then took their property and then buried the fact that it happened. And seven Jews were escaped, only seven. And they somehow found their way to this incredible woman, and that's where the title comes from, Waskowski Antonia, who has this Catholic woman whose faith was so powerful and so beautiful that she put her family, herself and her family, at risk to save these people. I mean, her husband, everyone was terrified of this, because they knew what it meant. They dug a hole in underneath their barn where the cat animals fed and defecated, big enough for seven people, four to stand and three to sleep or something like that. And for 2.5 years, she saved all of them, and they ended up loving her, and of course. But at great cost to her family, when the Germans would come with dogs and the neighbors would suspect that the only reason anyone would be doing this is they took money from Jews. When the money ran out, they would turn them over to the Germans. So suspected her. So she did this. The title comes from this because where did she find it? Did she find this almost unbelievable courage? Mm. Her son, a draft dodger now in the 60s, doesn't have any wherewithal, and he's hoping by translating her diaries that he'll find some, that he'll understand because he has mixed feelings. His mother put him through hell. Right. He has mixed feelings. He wonders if he himself is something of an anti-Semite. He killed his best friend in a game of chicken, shooting soup cans off there. And this is the son of a survivor. Now, I made him up. She's a real woman who is enshrined at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, and she's enshrined as righteous among nations. She's a great hero. She's a real woman. But I'm taking her and making her into a character.
And you have made up her son, who is struggling with,
right,
I think, all the things that you described. Even going back to what happened in this Polish town, I guess the controversy, and then I do want to get to your book, the controversy was whether the Nazis had ordered the massacre of the Jews or whether this was done in a more kind of spontaneous manner in this town.
They had come in and they were, you know, they were around the final solution hadn't yet begun. They had literally just occupied the town. And they, of course, it was okay with them to round up and kill Jews. But they did feel that they were still useful to them. And this was a decision made on the part of the mayor and the officials of town. And it was made for all kinds of reasons, profound anti-Semitism. Well, before it got to this point, the Jewish elders went to the mayor and they went to the priest, the head priest, for help, who had always been somewhat kindly. And he said, no, the Jews, because previously the town had been occupied by the Soviets. And one of the reasons the townspeople were giving is that the Jews were collaborators. With the Soviets, as if they themselves hadn't, but they saw this as the case. And that the communism was, to some degree, in their eyes, a Jewish conspiracy, Marx and Lenin. The Soviets, ironically, were more anti-Semitic than and were doing their share of killing, too. But the Jews had somehow survived the Soviets, and they didn't survive the Germans.
And this is a story. I mean, there are many stories at the heart of your story. And is it about denial? Is it about complicity? Is it about the capacity for violence? I mean, that you're sort of asking all of us to perhaps put ourselves in some other people's shoes and imagine what would we do?
That's a great question. And I think I felt the biggest response when you said that. I had many reasons for writing this. And I was surprised at the last section when I went from I, when he's talking about what happened, to we, that it's a the human capacity for greed and violence unchecked. She says in one of her, the mother says in one of her diaries that she now escapes and they're living in Chicago, and that's, she looks around at the ushers and movie houses and waiters and restaurants and wonders if they were suddenly these nice people, the a basketball coach, if they were suddenly given the opportunity with impunity to take someone's house, to have their clothes, their car, because they could, would they?
Right.
How for the townspeople in this town, it was like a gold mine in their backyard that they didn't know was there, hadn't known was there.
Do you think about that question yourself?
Under those horrible
conditions?
Well, I'm a poet. I like philosophy. You would think that we're moral. So I'm not just looking at them as they and us. In this, and then I compare in the book, a good part of the book, in fact, takes place in San Francisco in the 60s, and the Zodiac Killer, who's a maniac, and I compare him to Hitler, and that kind of, if the Zodiac Killer suddenly was given the largest, most powerful army in the world, in the history of the world, what would he do? And so it is about, on some level, basic level, about an examination of human, taking away nothing from what the Nazis did and what these townspeople did, because they, in fact, did do it. Right. Everything else is questionable as a matter of just the human capacity for evil.
Well, on that note, let's take a very short break, and I do want to get back to our conversation, and I actually want to have you read from the very beginning of your novel, Philip Schultz, but just this quick reintroduction. Our guest is Philip Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. He's also the author of a new novel. It's a novel in verse called The Wherewithal, drawn in part from this terrible massacre in Poland at the very beginning of World War II. We're going to take a very short break, have a reading, and talk some more. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers, a powerful story of the truth and tragedy of war as told by a young soldier struggling to find meaning in his harrowing experiences in Iraq while feeling alienated upon his return home. A joint project of the Office of the Mayor and the Free Library of Philadelphia, One Book, One Philadelphia features 8 inspired weeks of discussions, performances, and workshops through March 19th. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library of Philadelphia proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? We rely on you, our listeners, to help pay for the news and information service that we provide around the clock. It's really very simple. You decide what this service is worth. $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. Then you pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499. You'll talk to a volunteer who will ask some very basic questions, and presto, you're done. Or you can go online to WHYY and do it yourself. It's really very simple. It's also the right thing to do, since once you know what you're getting for your contribution. We keep you informed about the local, national, and international news, and we introduce you to interesting people and ideas. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-WHYY. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Thank you very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with poet Philip Schultz. He's written a long poem, as he told me during the break. He doesn't even like the subtitle to his book. It's called The Wherewithal. The subtitle is A Novel in Verse. He thinks of it as a long poem, which makes sense because he is a poet. And we've been talking about some of the history that went into the creation of this story or this poem. And I want to have Philip Schultz read from the very beginning of your new book.
Okay. Upstairs at San Francisco, 1968, April 17th, and every day the world spins faster on its axis, a little more off kilter, a little less in its right mind, bursting at its seams with desire for variation, while everyone everywhere around me appears to be fornicating in doorways and on rooftops and spiraling parks under transplanted palms, beside rhododendron beds, marching and waving fists and wheels of sweltering air, hurrying in every direction, possessed of an overflowing innocence and furious resolve and revolutionary zeal, indeed, hurling themselves against barricades of forlorn ideals and ancient decrees, throwing off rusty shadows and leafy, inane inner beings, singing unholy penitential psalms full of righteous sorrow, yes, forgiving nothing while remembering everything, while I, one Henry Stanislav Waskowski, head clerk of closed files, a department of one, work for the time being in a hole in the earth, hiding from the U.S. Army, from a vast personal history of defeat and occupation, of anger and despair, among other things. Work in a forgotten well of ghostly size, where, more often than not, it's Poland, 1941, June 25th, and in the town of Jawabne, a great massacre is taking place, and the world has stopped in its tracks.
And that's Philip Schultz reading from the very beginning of The Wherewithal. And I have to say, you had me at those first couple of lines there, a very powerful way to begin. And you know, I was wondering about you in 1968. I remember that year very well. Of course, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. There was so much going on in this country at the time.
And Martin Luther King.
And Martin Luther King, of course.
Yes. And it
where were you in 1968?
Well, I was in San Francisco.
I thought so.
And I was trying to avoid the draft. And because of that, I couldn't get a job. I mean, no one would hire anyone who could be sent off the next week or flee the country or whatever. And I and every young man I knew was in this situation. And it was, we didn't see it as a moral war, and therefore you couldn't fight it. So I lived with a suitcase under my bed. And I finally supplemented my income. I would do part-time jobs by being on food stamps. And one day I went from being on food stamps to being offered a job no one else wanted in the basement of Inactive Files, alone.
So were you the head clerk of Closed Files?
Yeah, well, I was the head clerk and my only employee.
Right. It was just you, yourself,
right,
in this basement office.
And I tried to write many novels about this over the years. For 30 years, I tried to write novels about it, and I never made it work because I didn't know what he was doing down there.
Yeah, even though you... That's you we're talking about.
Yeah, I tried to. That's great what you just said. Yes, because it was me, I didn't see him as a character. I was giving him all the stuff that happened to me. When I wrote this, once I knew who his mother was, he was this mm-hmm. character. He was Catholic and he was a philosophy student. He wasn't a writer. I completely made up a character, and I could look at him mm-hmm. on the stage an actor with other actors, and that gave me the distance I never had before.
At one point, I guess there's a window in his office so he can see shoes, people's shoes going by.
Fancy shoes,
exactly.
Downtown San Francisco.
Yeah, so here's this, you know, destitute, I guess, draft dodger looking at people's really nice footwear. A great image, yes?
Yes, and a lot of those images are right out of the novels. I had something like seven of them, and many of them went off and came back. And, so I had the atmosphere, and I knew that was the setting of a book I had to write. And it took me all those years to figure out what he was doing down there and who he was.
But for you, it's not a novel. It's a poem.
Well, you know, it's built like a novel. It reads like a novel. So, you know what they say? It's a novel. And everyone is referring to it. And it has 15 different narratives. And it has chapters. And all that novel writing I did gave me the narrative technique to be able to do this. As a poet writing 30-line poems, I never would have pulled this off. So, yes, it is a novel. The poet in me feels a little pushed to the side, wonders what's going on. All those line breaks, all those right
words. The novelist
words,
invading the poet.
Yeah.
The poet's mind.
He's taking over.
There is a character, and you already gave it away, so I don't feel so bad about giving it away. I guess a friend of Henry or Henrik's, a young man named Rossi. His father survived Treblinka. And his father is called the Survivor.
Yeah.
In this poem or in this story, and Rossi really looks up to Henrik. I mean, he's sort of like a puppy dog in a way, following him around.
Because he wants to be like him. He's cooler and, you know, girls like him. And he's something of an artist. And he also is tough because he went through so much as a kid.
Right.
And Rossi is trying to pull away from his father, who's a survivor. And there's a lot of guilt. And he's lived with
the guilt
this.
Of surviving.
The guilt, well, the father's guilt, and he wants to be an American. And Henrik, ironically, who's this Polish with this Polish history, he sees he's a very American kid. And Rossi wants to be like him. And Henrik lives with this terrible guilt that it was his idea to play this game of chicken, putting a soup can on Rossi's head and seeing if he could shoot it off and killing him. And he doesn't know. So that's one of the stories that runs through here. He doesn't know why he did it. And he fears that he himself is an anti-Semite, that his jealousy of these whole people that his mother loved more than she loved him, that she would sacrifice her whole family for them, that there's all these mixed feelings. And he has become a philosophy, a PhD student, a graduate student, and Wittgenstein he studies because he wants to understand. He's hoping that Wittgenstein will help him understand who he is and why he behaves the way he does.
In fact, it's Ludwig, I guess, Wittgenstein. He figures into this poem as well.
But he becomes a character. Ludwig.
He does become a character, and he says some pretty interesting things. What does it mean? What does it mean to know who is in pain? I mean, there's a lot of questions about empathy, about pain, about, you know, if you're a bystander, you don't do anything, are you complicit? These seem to be the questions that sort of swirl around in this story.
I think I knew early on that I needed a Ludwig. Not only is he another character who is kind of a guide to, to Henrik, through hell, so to speak. But he offers a philosophy that helped me. I knew in writing this book that I need as much armor as I could find. That I would be, it's going to take years and years, and I'm living with a feeling of dread and grief that I needed to, I needed the humor of the San Francisco sections, I needed Ludwig, I needed distancing techniques that would allow me to survive these feelings. And Ludwig helped a lot. Yeah. His philosophy was...
And the feelings of of guilt yourself or of, well, of you this know, history?
You'll appreciate this. You did the memoir. As a dyslexic, I read very slowly. And
Your memoir, My Dyslexia.
Yeah, yes. I knew that this was not a subject I could take on unless I knew something about it. And therefore, I was going to have to read books. And they all seemed like very fat books. They were all histories. And I avoided, somehow got through school, avoided my whole life reading a lot of books. And I had to read a lot of history. I just had to. And I did. I tricked myself. I used one of my dyslexic tricks. When I read one book, the bookmark moved so slowly that it was defeating. So I read seven or eight at a time, and therefore I couldn't keep track of all the different bookmarks. So one would end, and another one would end, and I found a way of reading these histories because I really did need to know something. So I did more reading probably on this subject than I did ever as an English major, undergraduate or graduate. I mean, it was probably 8 years of reading, very slowly.
Did you not know some of this history, or you were reading accounts that
I was completely ignorant. I mean, whatever I thought I knew, I don't think
really?
I knew what I knew. History has changed up until not too long ago, maybe 10 years ago. Now I'm getting out of my... Oh, boy.
Sorry. Okay. This is live radio. You know, I'm going to use this opportunity to reintroduce you.
Yes.
Philip Schultz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and we're talking about his long poem called The Wherewithal. It has just been published, and that was just his phone ringing. Speaking of phone, let me give you our phone number if you want to join our conversation, and it's 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WH. H-Y-Y. I want to pick up on, you were talking
sure.
about your all the research that you did for this, and there's a quote from Wittgenstein in your book, what is internal is hidden from us.
Right, like we don't know the lion, what the lion's really thinking, and we
yeah.
don't know what we're really thinking. And to answer your question, I knew nothing. I knew less than nothing.
Did you not want to know? I mean, or is it?
It wasn't a subject I was dying to become an authority on, and I'm certainly far from an authority, but I just realized that I had to know something about what happened in that history, and then I didn't. In the last several years, the historians have found a way of reading testimonies, personal testimonies, diaries, memoirs. Interviews with victims, with survivors, because they never could be credited before because there were so many different Rashomon, there were so many different views of what happened. But so they relied, believe it or not, on mostly German documentation and record taking, and then they discovered to what extent that was fudged and erased and changed. And then they found a way, a scientific way, of appreciating testimony, personal mm-hmm. testimony. They just drew a circle, and they realized that that area, that nexus of agreement, was the truth, or the closest they were going to come to it. And they started to interview, and they found a different picture and understanding of the Holocaust through that.
I'd love to have you – that first reading was great, and I'd love to have you read another section from the book. I'm passing this over to you. Unlike Auschwitz, it begins there. And this is – I should say to our listeners, Rossi, the friend of Heinrich, his father is a survivor, one of the few survivors, I guess, of Treblinka.
And he keeps hair. That's what his job is. His job was to collect the hair of women who had been killed and make baskets. So he still collects like Rossi's hair. He can't get out of the habit. Unlike Auschwitz or Birkenau, which endorsed the illusion of a workplace, Treblinka, a train platform and a one-way road to eternity, was a place, Rossi's father told Rossi, where illusion didn't exist. Just corpses burning all night on grills, greasing the sky with an effluvium medieval in its bite, inspired perhaps by the unspent imaginations of generations, where a lucky few survived by pulling precious gems from the teeth of the dead and cut and swept miles and miles of women's hair, which, as a history of brushings and intimate caresses, were stored faithfully in woven baskets in the survivors' dreams. At night he covered with sand the body pits which turned red in the morning light. Once or twice a hand or foot twitched on the surface, indicating perhaps what the Dead Sea Scrolls prophesized, that the final war between those of heightened purity and those who walk in the wicked way had arrived. On a garage shelf under which on a tiny army cot the survivor slept, boxes were labeled Rossi's Black Curls at 19 weeks, at 53 months, at year 8, etc. Hair cut over Rossi's protests, of course. The day after I killed his son, the fires at Treblinka were turned on me.
Oh, it's just sort of takes your breath away when that particular section. Do you know survivors like Rossi's father?
I do. As a child, I grew up in the 50s in Rochester, New York, and overnight the street was inundated with survivors from DP camps. I didn't understand that they were survivors. Right. And they mostly stayed in a boarding house, one or two boarding houses, and they never really fit in. They dressed differently. They were all in various stages of despair and shock. And the other immigrants that had come earlier never really fully accepted them. And I, because I grew up in my grandmother's house, knew Yiddish. So one in particular who had been a musician in, a wonderful musician in Krakow, hired me to write letters for him. And then I wrote letters for others. I translated their letters from Yiddish into English or whatever. I have a long poem called Living in the Past where I wrote about this. I discovered at one point that the letters I was writing for Mr. Schwartzman were all to dead people. That he...
Family, friends,
he had lost
neighbors.
Everyone. His career, he lost everyone. And that he was keeping alive the illusion of family and that the purpose I was serving. And I was devastated when I found that out.
But it's kind of a noble purpose, isn't it? I mean, it's disconcerting, but
I was so young. I don't think I understood. But
yeah, do you understand it now?
Well, I remember back hearing being on the porch and listening to all their conversations, and I think that was the genesis, in many ways, of a very personal relationship with that world.
Yeah.
It was my youth. It lasted from the time before I was bar mitzvahed to through into a teenager. And that I was given a window, a glimpse into a world of... None of them really remarried or ever joined the community or went to shul or no matter how religious, they were law. I'm not saying that, we find different... very different cases where people come and have whole lives.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation again. Pulitzer Prize winning poet Philip Schultz is our guest, and we are talking about his new book. It's called The Wherewithal, and he's the founder and director of the Writer's Studio. We're going to talk more and probably another reading from the book as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY as part of the Strauss 150th Anniversary Year. Legendary pianist Emmanuel Axe joins the Philadelphia Orchestra to perform the youthful Burlesque, plus the first piano concerto of Johann Sebastian Bach. And Vladimir Yurovsky conducts Bach's Second Suite. Tickets online at philorg.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Emmanuel Axe, Vladimir Yurovsky, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the winter membership campaign, and we want you to become a member, a supporter, a subscriber. If your membership has lapsed or you've never been a member, do it now, and it's really very simple. I know you'll feel good when you do it. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, we're doing a preview of the Winter Olympics at Sochi with three guests, a Time reporter Sean Gregory on security, NPR's Tom Goldman on the athletes, and the Associated Press's Stephen Wilson in Sochi. Then our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz, who has written a new novel in verse. That's the kind of diverse programming you hear every day on Radio Times. We're curious about many things, and we think you are too. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. I first interviewed Philip Schultz when his memoir, My Dyslexia, was published. That was a couple of years ago. His new book, a novel written in verse, I will say that, is called The Wherewithal. And again, about a young man hiding from the draft board in San Francisco, working at a number of menial jobs and trying to come to terms with a massacre of Jews in Poland during the Second World War. And I should add, this is a massacre that truly happened. Schultz is founder and director of the Writers Studio. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Heinrich, in your story, is translating the diaries his mother kept, again, based on a true person. She's older now. She has Alzheimer's. And what really broke my heart is that he says about his mother that she forgot what she wanted to remember, but she remembered what she wanted to forget. I mean, just the cruelty of that, just the breathtaking cruelty of that.
Well, my mother had Alzheimer's, and you lose all recent memory. So in this case, this woman, the part of her life in Chicago that made sense, she lost. And she's back in Yavabne permanently.
And remembering what had happened.
Over and over
and in
again.
A sense, what she did to her children, would you say?
Yes. I mean, you know, once you write something, it's up for grabs. It's like it's owned by others. And, you know, from his point of view, he paid quite a price. He didn't have a childhood. And she refers several times to when people came and beat her up.
Yeah. And he was there.
And he was there and tried to protect her once. And it's a drama. So you're making her faith was such that she didn't have a choice. She couldn't let these people she knew. She knew these people. She cared for them. She watched some of these girls grow up. She couldn't let them be killed. You know, when you ask yourself that, could you? I mean, that's hard.
Yes, it is.
It's hard on both sides.
I don't think we
sides.
Know the answer to
no,
that question.
We don't know the answer. And I think that's one of the questions. I know there are no answers in this book. I'm just asking questions.
You write about her. She talks about her. Maybe Heinrich says about hiding the kind of constant alarm. That's the word or the description of, which I can imagine. If you're in hiding, you can never for a moment not be in hiding, not be vigilant, not be worried that something is going to happen to you or happen to the people who are protecting you.
Well, now he's hiding from the U.S. Army, but it's just an endless form of hiding. It's one thing after another in his case, and he's really hiding from himself, and he's trying to figure out who he is down there.
Yeah, and, down there working in this department. He takes over this job from someone whose name is S-W-I-G-G-E. I don't know.
Swig.
Swig.
I mean, I'm hearing interesting pronunciations.
Yeah.
Who's quite a character in himself and who's something of a, he's writing his own notebooks called Notebooks of a Nobody. And he's something of a sociologist trying to understand the history of the poor. And cares about them and wants to understand what our attitudes are toward the poor, which is interesting because in all these versions of the novel that I wrote over the years, I guess I was dealing in my way with inequality and the purpose that the poor serve in humanity because there are largest minority, just like Jews are a large minority, the poor are, and I'm comparing them. And I have always been interested in sociology and that. So it's interesting that the Pope, whose feelings, great love of the poor, would come out now and his interest in inequality at a time when I finally finished this book.
Yeah.
And that's Swig's approach. Everything that the Pope is saying, he, of course, is agreeing with. And
kind of prescient.
That we need them to feel like unpoor or important, that they serve a purpose, and that the welfare buildings, at least certainly for a long time, the main purpose they serve is to hide the poor from view. And to their budgets mean give as little to as many as possible, give as to as few as possible, and enough basic sustenance. And the attitudes that we have toward the poor, so that's like 40 years of reading about it and dealing with it here. And suddenly it's in the news. Well, I emerge from my own basement, my own dungeon.
And find that people are talking about what you're talking about.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book.
One hapless Tuesday morning, her big blue dilated eyes startled to find me in Swig's chair, a tall, fetchingly beleaguered, young, familiar-looking blonde woman in a cowhide miniskirt and billowy peasant blouse, appears out of the fluorescent haze, asking, "Swig, he still work here?" "He's dead, gone, missing, and or deceased," I say. "Well, we kind of had an arrangement." "Which was," she said, "in return for PA extensions, which Swig delivered," he wrote in his notebooks, "by ghostwriting love letters for Mrs. Cafiso in Central Index to a Stevie boy in maintenance, she posed for him, sometimes with a girlfriend, it being what he wanted. Was there something I wanted? You don't like photos, there's other things." After leaving her case number and phone number, she disappeared magnificently into the same shadows she had appeared out of only moments before. Under his Tijuana gold, much tampered with paper clips, neatly dated and immaculately written notepads in Swig's bottom drawer, I find files labeled "For My Eyes Only," in which one is entitled "Hetty Butterfly, 22 years old, 18 months on PA, that's public assistance, 10 extended psychiatric visits, youngest of 8, father abandoned kids from Big Sky, Montana, mother committed to a Seattle psych ward, father in prison, part-time go-go girl, 2 arrests for drug dealing, 3 abortions paid by us, 1.5 suicide attempts, along with 15 photos of her and another girl, posing, let us say, somewhat provocatively, which is why she looks so familiar. 1.5 suicide attempts? My pulse 21 knots. A very ungentle breeze.
That's Philip Schultz reading from his book, a long poem that we have been talking about, The Wherewithal. She seems very real to me.
Does she?
She does. She does.
Well, you know, I won't go there. No. When I was down there, I would read at random case histories, and sometimes I'd come across people I knew. College friends were getting psychiatric aid, and this is a composite of many characters that I read about and knew, and I also wanted it to be the 60s, and this is a love interest. He falls for her, and she's someone who goes from man to man and eventually leaves him, and
she's a survivor, too.
She's
been through hell.
A lot. And the suicide attempts, I feel a real compassion for all these people and the file. And I talk about various files, and they become characters, too.
Let me get that. Looks like Monica from Brewery Town to join our conversation. Monica, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Hi there.
I have a question for your guest and also a concerned voice. Maybe you mentioned it at the beginning of the program, but what part of Poland was Jedwabne at?
What part of Poland?
It was the eastern. It was a German. It was a western Poland, and because the Germans occupied the western part, but it was like the eastern part. It was not far from the eastern border.
Is it the south? You know, is it on the north?
Or? I think it's the. I don't believe it's the northern. I'm trying to imagine and remember the map, which I had to study. But I think it's so close to the eastern part, to the Soviet.
Occupation line. Okay, I am a Pole from the western Poland. I have never heard the particular story that you're referring to. But I'm also concerned with the picture of Poland that you paint on the program, because at that time that you're referring to, Poland was not at the map. It was Germany. It was not Poles who profited from the war. It was Germans. So I'm a little disturbed by the picture of your painting.
Yeah, Monica, I appreciate it. We're talking about a small piece of history, not all of Poland.
Yes.
Or all Poles.
Well, the book that this is based on, called Neighbors, is based on and full of depositions. There was a real Jedwabne did happen, and there were many, many Jedwabnes. It was very hard for the Poles after the war to accept this, but there was trials in which some of the perpetrators, the murderers, were convicted and tried. And a lot of the information that I'm using in the book is based on depositions in which eyewitnesses were confessing and giving facts to. So this was, when Neighbors came out, and I believe in 2001, this became a scandal and a cause of great attention in Poland. And it fostered an incredible debate among the Polish people. And I think most of the intellectuals just accepted that the truth of it, and that not only during the war, but as Jan Gross points out, there was a lot of pogroms and anti-Semitism after the war too. Yes, my heart goes out to you. Mm. I can understand how hearing that. If this is not something you know about, and how dismaying. It must be to hear that, and but the depositions and were from the Polish people who committed these crimes, and they were facts.
Mm. Monica, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm actually looking at a piece that we found in the New York Times. It's about 10 years old, but nonetheless, talking about a public prosecutor, investigations. There were several trials and a number of people that were convicted of killing Jews in this particular town. So, yes, a very disturbing story indeed. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And again, our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz. And again, Radio Times here on WHYY. I want to go back to this story in San Francisco and the Zodiac Killer. He makes several appearances in this story. And at one point, Heinrich is driving a cab. And I read that you drove a cab for a while in San Francisco, too.
I always wanted to write about this incident. Because of my draft status, I couldn't get jobs. And I'd go down to Yellow Cab and never get hired. And I'd go all the time. And one day I got hired. And I saw myself in an empty locker room. I had no idea why. I was so poor. I didn't have a television, and I hardly ever read newspapers. And so I was out on the streets, and I soon discovered I was the only cab out on the streets.
Oh my God.
And my first ride that I picked asked me if I was crazy or suicidal, that the Zodiac, who always named his victims the night before, said he would get a cabbie next. So, of course, everyone was smart enough not to drive that day, except for me. I was on the streets, And it was an incident that I remember. I was terrified. I not only wouldn't stop for anyone else, I wouldn't let the guy who was on.
That's a great way to make money as a cabbie.
I know. Well, so I have various adventures as a cab driver and with various riders. And,
yeah. Including some scary ones, potentially scary ones, I guess. Do you remember your draft number? Did you have a draft number?
No. I think you're thinking of the lottery.
Happened.
No, this was before the lottery. Okay. This was if you were in school or you were in Vietnam. And the protests were at a height, and a lot of young men were just simply saying, we won't go, so you're going to have to arrest. I mean, it was at the height of this in 68 and 69. And Heinrich is 1 year away from 26 when you're no longer draft eligible. So he's in hiding. And I was in school most of that time.
We're almost out of time here, but this book or this story ends with this Heinrich's mother. We won't be able to read it, but mother sort of writing to him a letter, which is all sort of broken up phrases. I mean, her language, I guess, is deteriorating or perhaps becoming poetry itself. I wasn't sure exactly how to read that.
Oh, you mean the last?
The very last, yeah, which she's writing
yes,
to him.
Yes, I have to say I made that up. Well, the last section was something I had to build myself up for, where she's actually, let's say that with philosophy and history, you write about an event and you give the facts. With a poem, I knew I had to go in the barn. It was something that I wasn't looking forward to. And so as a way of doing it, Heinrich takes acid. He drops a tablet of acid. And he wants to experience what he imagines is his mother's dementia and her eyewitness account of what happens. And it ends with this inferno and this conflagration. And
And a Kaddish.
And a Kaddish, right.
Well, on that note, Philip Schultz, thank you for joining us today in Radio
thank
Times.
You.
The book is called The Wherewithal, the long poem, the novel in verse, The Wherewithal. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Emily Hawes on the telephones today for us. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, ma'am.